Welcome to Books and Ideas Audio, a presentation of the Vancouver Writers' Fest. The Vancouver Writers' Fest connects people to exceptional books, ideas, and dialogue through year-round programming that ignites a passion for words and the world around us. We carry out our work on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. This month on the podcast, we're delighted to share a conversation between Eleanor Wachtel, the renowned, recently retired host of CBC Radio 1's Writers & Company, and German-Lebanese writer Pierre Jarwan, the author of Song for the Missing, which Publishers Weekly called a gripping human look at a tragedy that still haunts an entire nation. They joined us at last year's festival, where this event was recorded live on October 21st, 2022. This conversation was also released on Writers & Company on November 25th, 2022. Thank you to our public and private sponsors. Our public sector funders are the Government of Canada, the Canada Council for the Arts, the BC Arts Council, the Government of BC, the City of Vancouver, and CMHC Granville Island. And we couldn't do our work without them, so thank you.
Welcome to the 35th Vancouver Writers' Fest. I'm Eleanor Wachtel, host of CBC Radio's Writers & Company. And it's a great pleasure for me to be here again in person in a place that continues to feel like home, a city I never really left, despite moving to Toronto a few decades ago. We'll be recording tonight's event, my conversation with Pierre Jarwan, for broadcast on our show. Pierre Jarwan is a novelist and former champion slam poet. He was born in Amman, Jordan in 1985 to a Lebanese father and German mother. The family moved to Germany when he was three. Pierre published his debut novel, The Storyteller, in 2016. It became a bestseller, and he was named a Literature Star of the Year by Abenen Zeitung, the city's daily newspaper, and his new novel is called Song for the Missing. Please welcome Pierre Jarwan. Your father's bedtime stories, you've said, were the early inspiration for your own career as a writer. What were they like? What made them so captivating?
My father was very... He kind of blend into the history of the tradition of oral storytelling, because my father wasn't a writer. He never wrote, and there are no writers in our family. He was a street worker, but somehow he had a very lively fantasy, and he made up stories about talking animals, for example, and he just entertained us when we were children, and we were exposed to books also a lot, so I was surrounded by stories, you can say.
Do you know where your father got his gift for storytelling? I mean, was it a family tradition, or was it part of the culture? Or
It's probably more culture than tradition, because nobody in our family ever wrote any books or stories or poetry. It was really, but you have in the Middle East, you have this long tradition of oral storytelling, and maybe this is where he got his talent from.
Were there particular stories that caught your imagination as a child? I mean, that stayed with you over the years?
I don't remember. I couldn't tell you a full story he told us, but the characters, you know, these speaking animals. We had Jamal Jamul. This is a crazy dromedar, for example.
Is that a single or a double humped camel?
I think it's single. So very funny stories that made us laugh.
You shared this experience, this idea of being told stories as a child, with Samir, the central character of your first novel, The Storyteller. And in that book, Samir's father told mythical stories about Lebanon before disappearing when his son was eight. And the now adult Samir leaves his family home in Germany to search for him back in Beirut. You said that novel draws on your own biography. Did your own father return to his homeland?
No, my father is not living in Germany anymore. He lives in Abu Dhabi. But he, when I was young, I got a feeling for his struggle to feel at home in Germany. You know, it started with the language. He had trouble speaking it fluently, and although he spoke it well, but somehow I think he kept feeling a stranger in Germany. So when he left it, he never went back to Lebanon. But now in Abu Dhabi, he lives in an Arab-speaking country, which probably is the closest he can feel home to.
Do you know why he didn't go back to Lebanon?
I mean, it's not really a country that... it's a country you leave, but it's a country you don't go back to, at least not for to stay there forever, which has economic reasons, which might, I don't know that, also have reasons in his past. My father was 18 when the Civil War started, and we never spoke about that, although I tried tried getting answers, but this is something he kept with himself. So I don't know that. It is something I can only speculate on. I think it was really just the simplest explanation could be that he got this job offer in Abu Dhabi and just went there.
You were much older than this character, Samir, when your father left, but was his departure a kind of rupture for you?
I don't really remember it because it wasn't abrupt. My parents got divorced when I was 13, and he lived in Germany for 7 more years, just not with us. But we visited him regularly, and he prepared us for him leaving Germany. So it wasn't like we woke up and he was gone. No, so this part in the first book is not drawn from, mm-hmm. from my autobiography. No,
it's much more dramatic to have him disappear.
Yeah, it's a better story.
Your mother, who's German, was working in Lebanon as a teacher when she met your father. How did they get together?
In Lebanon, you have one school that has a long tradition because it was founded by a German pastor of bringing over Germans to work with the students. And it's one of the rare schools in Lebanon where Christian and Muslim children go to together. And it's also for students from a poor backgrounds. And my father was already working there when she got there, and that's how they met. And the war was already going on. It started in 75, and they met, I think, in 79 in that school. But by 82, it had gone so bad and so dangerous that they had to leave the country, and they went to Saudi Arabia, where my brother was born, and then they went to Jordan, where I was born. And when I was 3, we went to Germany, where my sister was born. So three children, 3 countries.
So I was going to ask you about multicultural background, but there it was in your home.
Yeah, it was
so,
home.
Your being born in Amman, Jordan, came about because your parents wanted to get away from Lebanon, and that was the route out?
Yeah, right. I would have been born there if it wasn't for the war.
When you were 3, your family moved to Germany, but you say you never regarded yourself as the child of refugees, that being half Lebanese with a German mother, a Lebanese father, made you special, not foreign. Were there any difficulties for you in that dual identity?
No, when I was a child, I remember it as something I was very proud of. And when we went to Lebanon every year, and it kind of led to, and probably this makes me a typical second generation immigrant, a second generation child of immigrants, that you kind of romanticize your parents' country when you're a child, because you only experience in summer for a couple of weeks. It's always the sun, you see your family, you go, you have the food, the ocean, then you go back and you remember the positives things. And what is kind of weird is that we went there throughout the 90s, but I have no memories of Beirut being destroyed, although it was. So it's just not there. And what I remember is the beauty and the summer vacation. So, when I was in Germany, I was talking about Lebanon as if it was paradise on earth. And only later I learned that, of course, this is only half the truth. And it was kind of a painful process to allow that to myself, to see the country and all the ugliness happening there. And it took a while.
And as a kid in Germany, and you grew up near Stuttgart, so the other students just heard about your paradise, and that was just a part of who you were, or?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that we had a shisha at home made me have many friends when I was a teenager. It was really nothing special, because in the small town there were many Lebanese immigrants also. But I have to say that me growing up was probably very different from them growing up, because their parents were in most cases all Lebanese, and me having a German mother and also my appearance not being very Arabic, I think was a privilege, because I never experienced any kind of racism or prejudices or something. It was really just clear that this is second home. His father is from Lebanon. He knows the country. He has a shisha, and that was it.
What did you smoke on the shisha? It's a water pipe?
Yeah, it's a water pipe. Yeah, it's some tobacco with a strawberry flavor or something. It's But I was going to say that me growing up was very different from friends of mine, you know, so who had darker eyes, darker skin, and it was kind of, for them it was kind of like growing up in a parallel universe, probably.
What impressed you the most in these childhood visits to Lebanon?
Seeing my relatives and somehow being shown that, or being also told that this is that you are welcome there, that this is your second home. And in Germany, I often got asked, you know, what do you consider home? Is it Germany or Lebanon? And somehow they made me feel I had to decide on the question. But I never understood why I can't have two, right? Because I considered both countries home. When I was in Germany, and still am, I consider it my home. And when I'm in Lebanon, I feel home too, but it's different today. It's more painful being there today, realizing and knowing the history now, and also seeing, you know, I was in Beirut 3 weeks ago. It has become very dark, literally. There's no electricity, and the harbor still looks like the explosion happened yesterday.
This is in 2020.
So. It's different today.
Pierre Jarawan, you said that, you know, it was your father's imaginative storytelling that helped make you a novelist, but before that, you had a successful career as a slam poet. And it sounds surprising to those of us who aren't familiar with the slam poetry scene in Germany that you could make a living at it. Tell me about it. What drew you to that?
I started writing when I was 13. And I wrote poetry, short stories. And when I was 16, I tried writing or starting my first novel, never finished. And when I was 18, I started another one, never finished it. Simply because I had no story to tell. If you read the text, you realize this is something who wants to write because he loves reading, but he has no story to tell, no own story. It was like a mixture of all the movies and novels I had read so far. So, but I had written for a couple of years when I learned about slam poetry or poetry slams being a thing in Germany, which is, you know, people going to, for example, theaters, watching poets on stage perform, and it's a competition. So the audience decides in the end who wins. That's a poetry slam. And I mean, what attracted me was probably just the fact that when you write, I think you're always looking for someone telling you that what you write is somehow, you know, worth writing about. So, and in that regard, slam poetry or poetry slams are really a good place to start, because you get your feedback immediately while you perform on stage, and so it seemed to me like a place I could find, you know, refuge with my writing, and it turned out to be a good way to improve.
Well, it sounds like it was winning slam poetry that was the real reward. I mean, in terms of refuge, because presumably if you continue to lose, you wouldn't have stayed in the game.
Yeah, I mean, it is a competition, but I think the competition is more of a trick to attract audience, really. If you have two posters and one says, you know, young people read poetry on stage, and one says, you decide who's going to win a poetry competition, you go to the second one. But for us, it wasn't so much, or it isn't so much about winning. It's nice if you win, but there are many people who have great quality on stage, but they're not very successful for what reasons ever. But they are keep being invited, and they teach in workshops and so on. So they're also able to make a living. But winning helps.
How would you describe your own performances? Is it poetry or storytelling? Do you improvise, or is your work all written out? I mean, what?
It's not improvised. Although the longer you do it, you learn how to improvise on stage, and to, if something happens, you just react. But that's experience. It's a mixture of poetry and I never really did just poetry or just storytelling. I did both, and whatever was, you know, best for what I was talking about. Sometimes poetry felt more natural to express what I wanted to express, and sometimes it was a story. But you have a time limit, of course. Internationally, it's usually 3 minutes. In Germany, we have 6 minutes, which leads probably to the fact that that more stories are being told, just because you have more time to do so.
And are these stories your own invention?
I'm sorry?
Are these stories your own invention?
But it's not so much. This is also a big difference. It's when you perform on stage and you say "I," the people. There's a difference to the novel, right? People reading a novel will not necessarily overlap those eyes, but on stage it's impossible to say "I" without the audience thinking that this is you, and so it makes no sense pretending that it's not you. So you write about yourself.
You said that slam poetry was the best school for you as a novelist, even though they're different. In what way?
Well, if you consider, for example, the chapter of a novel as a somewhat short text, slam poetry can be a good school, you know, learning in what works, really. It's just a basic question. What works, what keeps the audience reading, or what keeps the audience attracted? So when I wrote the first book, I found that it felt easy, you know, ending a chapter at a point where you wanted to know more, you wanted to read on with a cliffhanger or something. And I had the feeling that it was slam poetry that somehow helped me getting there.
For your first novel, The Storyteller, you've said you wanted to tell the story of the second generation of Lebanese immigrants in Germany, which of course includes you and your siblings. Why? What did you want to explore there?
I think it's not only Lebanese immigrants. Of course, in the book it's Lebanese immigrants, but I think the feeling that I wanted to show or make experienceable to the audience is somehow universal to second generation immigrants, which is, in Germany we have this saying, you know, sitting between two chairs, not here, not there, but somehow in between. And we also hear this a lot from Turkish, from young Turkish teenagers in Germany, who will say that, you know, in Germany I'm always the Turkish person, but in Turkey I'm the German. So the question of who am I, where do I belong, what is my home country, and constantly people asking you where is your home, what do you consider home, doesn't help. But most of them were either very small when they came to Germany like me, or they were born there. But sometimes parents, after 30 years, still not speaking German very well, you come home from an environment where you're surrounded by German friends in school, for example, to a home where your parents watch Arabic TV, cook Arabic food. And somehow remembering their past, in many cases, leads to romanticizing the past. And telling story, you know, fabricating basically memories and leaving out the dark parts, and this leads also, I think this inflicts conflict in second generation, not in all cases, of course. There's in the book there also is a character, Yasmin, who's very different from Samir. She has no intention to go back to Lebanon whatsoever. She doesn't feel attracted. She says, I'm here, my father brought us here to have a better life, so this is what I'm trying to achieve. But I think it goes for many people, this feeling that somehow they struggle with their identity.
Because it wasn't their decision to leave in the first place?
Yeah, and also because it's really parents as role models somehow being, sounds harsh, but a bad example, you know, not really helping in finding or new roots here in this country.
As you've described the novel, the storyteller, it grew into something bigger and more complicated, because Lebanon itself is a very complicated place. I mean, so often at the center of Middle Eastern conflicts with its own complex communal makeup. You said it's impossible to write about Lebanon without writing about politics.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
Because in this country, everything is so political. If even a yellow T-shirt can be a political statement if you go to the wrong district of Beirut. And I learned that when I had already started writing, when I learned that that somehow I have to stop and do my research. And I had done research before, but this is really when I was at a point where I thought that I needed to understand the civil war, why it happened, who participated, what came from it. And it also really changed my own perspective on the country. And Lebanese politics is so unique also. You have no other country in the world where the parliament is like it is in Lebanon, because there's an agreement that says the Lebanese president always has to be a Maronite Christian, the Lebanese prime minister always has to be a Sunni Muslim, and the speaker of the parliament always has to be a Shia Muslim. So there is no separation between religion and politics. And although this dates back many years ago to the 40s, when Lebanon became the Lebanon today with its borders, it's something deeply rooted, you know, in the country, that you vote people because, or people get jobs in politics or wherever because they have a certain religion, and it's identification is about religion in many cases. And I have the feeling that it only started even after the war. You have the war entered in 1990, so 75 to 90, 15 years, and people born after the war, so now you were talking about a whole generation born after the war, even then, they still grew up in many cases with, you know, stories about the past. There is no history book in Lebanon in schools covering the years of the civil war, because they cannot agree on civil war. You have 17 different religions.
I thought it was 18.
12 of them. 12 of them are Christian, you have Druze, Sunni Muslim, Shia Muslim, and so on.
And this is in a country of 6 million.
Yeah, a very small country. Yeah, 6 million people. So you see why.
With different narratives and no official version of history.
Yeah.
I mean, what are the implications of that?
Well, it leads to, there's probably nothing more innocent than a post-war generation, but not in this case, maybe, you know, because they grow up with stories about the past. If there's no agreement, I mean, now you can debate, of course, if history isn't always some kind of story that people have agreed on at some point, right? But when that doesn't happen, the community you are born into really very much shapes the way you see the world, or you see Lebanon, or you see your community. And you have, in this case, 18 different stories about guilt and innocence. And of course, your community is innocent, and the others are the ones who did all the things. And this is dangerous, of course, because it never stops, right? You grow up with suspicion. You grow up with prejudice. You grow up with sometimes hatred, although nothing was ever done to you. But it's also we're you can also talk about transgenerational trauma. You know, being passed through stories about the past to the next generation. So it's complicated.
The epigraph to your first novel is a Lebanese saying: if you think you understand Lebanon, it's because someone has not explained it to you properly.
Yeah.
Is that really a Lebanese saying, or did you make it up?
No, it is a saying.
Pierre Charouan, in your latest novel, you venture into decades of Lebanese history, from the 15-year civil war, which ended in 1990, and the years of unrest that followed, right up to the Arab Spring of 2011. The title, Song for the Missing, has several layers of meaning. Within the story, it's the title of a painting created by the mother of the central character, Amin. Later, it's the title of an account that Amin himself comes to write. But more generally, who are the missing at the heart of this novel?
The missing are the people who have forcefully been... there were forceful disappearances in Lebanon, forced disappearances. 17,500 people are still missing in Lebanon. And if you look at the numbers, and when the war ended, there weren't 6 million people left in Lebanon. It was maybe 4 million. 17,500 missing is a huge number. And then again, you have to say that this is the official number, so probably there are more people missing. So this is the people dedicated, I wanted to dedicate the novel to, because this is not spoken about in Lebanon. It's a big gap. I went to Lebanon and I realized people my age, they sometimes don't even know that people are missing. And then again, you go to different parts of the city and they say, yeah, everybody here has someone in their family missing. And you know, it's really strange. Sometimes it's not being talked about. Sometimes it's suppressed. Sometimes it's like a trauma that is held up and lived even by the younger generation. They say, "Oh yeah, my grandfather or father disappeared," and it's there. It's all you go through the city, and they are there. They disappeared. They follow you somehow, but they're invisible at the same time. And when I started writing, it was very important to me to not write a Lebanese novel, or a novel that is somehow just about Lebanon. But I wanted to somehow include questions like that are somehow, I know it's a big word, but universal questions like, what does silence do to countries, to societies, to families, to friendships, if trauma isn't talked about? So this is what the novel essentially is about. And I think these are also very German questions, of course, but they can also be asked here in Canada. And I was walking downtown today, and near the arts gallery, there were some First Nation activists. You know, they had placed shoes of children on the stairs, and those were missing children. So you don't only have the disappeared in Lebanon, but people are disappearing right now in Ukraine, and they are everywhere. And it's very important that, maybe the most important sentence in the book is that, where he says that stories cannot bring back what is lost, but they can make us re-experience what is lost. And this is what made me write this novel. You know, I know nobody will come back from just because I wrote that book, but it becomes talked about.
There's also a sentence in the book where I think your main character says or thinks there can't be forgiveness, there can only be silence, mm-hmm. which is...
Yeah, it's not that I think that's a good thing. I think, again, this is dangerous, but many conflicts that come, you know, that keep the story going come from silence, and some of them would have been easy to avoid if people just sat and talked, but they lack language, they lack the ability to speak about what's hunting them.
The novel shifts between different periods and places, beginning with Amin as a teenage boy and later an adult. And like Samir in your earlier book, the storyteller, he's on a journey of discovery. Can you explain briefly what his situation is?
He has not lived, been in Lebanon during the Civil War. When he was a baby, his grandmother, she takes him and they leave the country to Germany. But the novel starts in 1994, so when they arrive in Lebanon again after the war. So it's not set in Germany or anything, it's just it's set in Lebanon, it arrives at that point, but that is the backstory. And he finds himself in a country where he was born in a city that he sees for the first time, and it's completely destroyed, and nobody's talking about what happened, but it's so visible, right? And so he finds one friend, Jafar, in school, who has experienced the war, and somehow they feel attracted by each other for different reasons. You know, for Jafar, for Amin, is someone who, from the naive perspective of a 13-year-old, somehow, you know, he lived through that danger. He lost even an eye, and he takes him into the ruins of the city, and they walk through these houses that have been left or destroyed. And on the other hand, Amin is, in the eyes of Jafar, someone who lived a life unimaginable for Jafar, which is a life in peace and a life, you know. I mean, if you were born in 75 in Lebanon, when the war ended, you were 15. For the 15 years of your life, you had experienced nothing but war. And these people are called the lost generation, you know, and I think it's somewhat true. And so they are attracted by each other, but they, at the same time, they can't really get too close to each other because there are too many things separating them. And there's also the grandmother. Jafar and the grandmother are probably the biggest characters. And there's a secret in her story, and there's a secret in Jafar's story, and this is what the story is about.
Telling stories is a theme of the novel. Could you read from the opening, just the beginning? Mm-hmm.
So the novel starts with Persian phrases, and in this beginning, the old Beirut is evoked, but I'm reading just a very short passage and stop. When it starts describing Beirut. Yeki Bud, Yeki Nabud. The best. The oldest stories in the world have always begun the same way. Once upon a time, or rather, there once was and there once wasn't. From a trove of Persian phrases, this one is the foundation, the driving force behind all storytelling, the opening of every fairy tale. Someone was there and someone wasn't there. There once was a time and there once was no time. Yeki Bud, Yeki Nabud. Your imagination is a leaning tower or a secret throne room. Listen to the hum of tidings and dreams. Look around. Take a deep breath. Olive groves and air redolent of resin. Something in the smell calls on you, Habibi Albi, to close your eyes and picture a white city. A city of fountains and soft light, the orchid of the Mediterranean. Close your eyes and think of Beirut, because there once was a city just as the elderly describe it, and there wasn't. Beirut before the war? Habibi Aini, Beirut meant sunshine, freedom, joie de vivre, summer nights at Pepe Abed's seaside tavern, where they served the most beautiful lobster and moored yachts rocked on the waves, the Saint-Tropez of the Levant. All year round, the warm scent of food rose from family picnics along the beach, mise bought at Abu Naim on Rue du Rafour with date-filled cookies for the little ones to enjoy on the rocky coastline. Shadows on the Azure Sea, Middle East airline flights descending, carrying a steady stream of tourists to the Paris of the Middle East. The light of dawn over the mountains flooding the city with color. That was the old Beirut. And so on.
Pierre Jean. Pierre Jarouin reading from the opening of his novel, Song for the Missing. It's translated from the German by Elizabeth Laufer. That repeated fairy tale refrain, once upon a time, what did you want to evoke through that?
I think the essence is, first of all, I wanted also the story to have kind of the atmosphere of a fairy tale in some parts. But I think the essence from the sentence is that there is no objective truth in memory, right? There was and there wasn't, depending on who you ask. And so this is, when I wrote the book, it was very different for me to write the book from the first book, because the first book, it took me only 8 months, and after doing my research for a couple of years, but the writing was 8 months. And when I started writing the second book, I thought, okay, writing a novel, roughly 8 months. So I started and I realized, okay, this has nothing to do with what I have experienced before. It took me 4 years and I deleted 350 pages through writing it. And so I basically wrote two novels, one.
So now when it says, yeah, there once was and there once wasn't, you're referring to your own novel.
Right. And it wasn't until I found the sentence I realized, okay, this is a story. There was and there wasn't, and also you have this character, Amin, constantly wanting you to believe that he is a reliable narrator, because he refers to a notebook, for example, that he had when he was a child, and he says, "Oh, I wrote down everything. This is what my memory relies on. When I write the story, I have these notebooks. They are full of memories I wrote down when I was a child." But the further the novel goes, you realize that somehow he's playing with you, and not only playing, he's realizing himself that there are gaps that can only be filled if he becomes a storyteller, if he fills it with a story that could be or could not be possible.
Well, he even says there's storytelling and then there's silence and the questions in between.
Yeah.
And the novel's about the questions in between.
Right.
Lebanese-German novelist Pierre Jarouin with me on stage at the Vancouver Writers' Festival. He's my guest today on Writers & Company on CBC Radio 1, on Sirius XM Radio, and available anytime on the CBC Listen app. I'm Eleanor Wachtel. Pierre Jarouin, the city of Beirut is central to your novel with its own complex character, its shadows and secrets. There's a saying which you quote that Beirut has been destroyed 7 times and 7 times it has risen again. Where does that come from? What's the story there?
I mean, it refers to, for example, earthquakes thousands of years ago, and it's a very ancient city, so yeah, it has been destroyed by earthquakes or by by war in total probably seven times, and seven times it has been rebuilt. And this is somehow referring to the resilience, you know, of the Lebanese people in general. And you also saw it in 2020 when this explosion happened. You know, as I said, I was there 3 weeks ago. The harbor itself, it looks like it happened yesterday, but the neighborhoods, they have been rebuilt. You barely see anything anymore of that explosion. You see that the windows are new, you know, and it was civil society. You know, the day after the explosion, they started rebuilding, because this is what they do. This is what they are used to. They know that they cannot rely on the state. The state did this, basically, you know, ignoring that there was explosive material, knowing but ignoring, not caring. So they are used to falling and standing up again, and this is also what kind of refers to these seven times of being destroyed and rising again.
Although seven, that just has such a biblical resonance too, you know.
True. Yeah.
In your novel, Song for the Missing, the teenage Amin comes to know the different sides of the city by day and by night, and he returns there with his grandmother, as you were saying, just 4 years after the end of the Civil War. The Beirut he discovers is a place also of many contradictions, very, very different from the place that his grandmother knew when she was young. What was that like? I mean, what was it like in the early 1990s?
As I said, I have no memories of Beirut being destroyed, which is weird because it was heavily destroyed, but it was also being rebuilt. So what I do remember is the sound of, you know, reconstruction, and it was still being reconstructed after 30 years. So up until to that explosion that kind of undid all that reconstruction that had been going on for 30 years. But I remember that, you know, reconstruction sites everywhere. When the war ended, yeah, there was kind of, the tourists were coming back in the 90s, kind of that spirit of the Paris of the Middle East, the old Paris that is kind of evoked in that beginning, that came back somehow. But at the same time, you know, you had immediately people not talking anymore about the war. It stopped, and it was kind of, it, of course, it wasn't forgotten, but it wasn't, it was somehow something you never talked about. And also there was an amnesia for the politicians, you know, who were militiamen in the war. And when the war ended, they became politicians.
Amnesia or amnesty?
Amnesty, I'm sorry.
It sounded probably both.
Yeah, they want amnesia, but that's what happened. So it was kind of a forced forgetting, you know. So again, you have this contradicting situation where there's people, you know, looking out to the future, rebuilding, at the same time this dark past looming over that all the time.
I think you have a reference to a billboard in your novel for real estate, and it's ancient Beirut, land of the future, or something. City of the future, or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, ancient Beirut, ancient city of the future.
Yeah.
It was a billboard in the 90s. Yeah, it really existed.
Yeah. Among Beirut's various landmarks, including Luna Park, an amusement park where some dramatic events happen in your story, there's the National Museum, and it becomes an important place for Amin, and his grandmother secures a kind of semi-volunteer job for him there. How is he enriched by the hours he spends at the museum?
In several ways. I mean, it's of course, the museum is also a metaphor as a place where memory is preserved, or the past is preserved. So outside of the museum, the past is it basically doesn't exist. It's not talked about. And then he enters the museum, which was heavily destroyed also in the war. They had all these ancient things, you know, somehow they rescued them in the war, and they were brought back, and so he's helping rebuilding the museum as a teenager and then he experiences, okay, there is a past, you know, here there's some, and it reaches back centuries, and this is the one part, and he meets someone in the old library of the museum, which has where all the books had been burned, and which also is of course kind of a metaphor when, you know, the extinction of all the stories that had been there, and he meets someone who's a so-called Hakawati, and the Hakawati are storytellers, and it's a long tradition of Hakawati in the Middle East, oral storytellers. They were, you know, very centuries ago, they were important men, families went to, and they spoke some kind of law. But then again, they are, until today, storytellers, as telling stories in public spaces, and for sometimes for weeks. They stop in the evening, and people go home, they return, and then the story continues. And it's really, it's a long tradition, and this is someone he meets. And he kind of becomes a teacher for him in, you know, how do you tell a story, and why is storytelling important, you know, and within that place of memory and destroyed memory, the museum, this kind of sparks his what he becomes later, which is the storyteller of his own story, and by inventing some parts of that and filling the gaps, he kind of becomes a Hakawati himself.
So would listening to a traditional, like a street artist who tells stories, a Hakawati, would it be anything like a poetry slam?
He would probably be violating the time limit. I don't know. Maybe, yes. I mean, again, the if you perform on stage, sometimes it's somehow very different from these stories and also novels, because you have to, which is kind of paradox, but you have to see that you are not too complex. You have to be simple somehow, because a listening audience, they only have this one moment. So if you use similes or metaphors, they don't make them too complicated, because people will try to, you know, decode what you just said while you, and this time you said five sentences and you lose them. So
would a Hakawati need to do the same thing though?
Yeah, but they don't.
It's different.
Yeah.
Amin's close friend Jafar seems to be the really creative, inventive storyteller in the novel, whether it's conning someone at the flea market into paying an inflated price for a used comic book, or fabricating an elaborate dramatic story about how he lost his eye, or just painting vivid scenes about the Civil War. He has a powerful imagination and a great gift. Did you ever know someone like him, or did you fabricate him to serve the purpose of making up all those stories?
Yeah, he doesn't have a real like role model in real life. I mean, many things happen subconsciously when you write, of course, but I wouldn't say that there's a person I know that he's drawn from. I fabricated him, yeah.
And this talent he has, where do you think that comes from?
Pardon?
The talent that he has to do this.
I mean, of course, it's partly his talent, but then again, it could be also escapism, you know, because he has trauma. And this is maybe what's the more powerful force behind him telling stories or fabricating stories.
As you mentioned earlier, these two characters come into play very strongly in this novel. One is Jafar, and the other is Amin's grandmother, Yara, who's a strong, complicated, resourceful woman of her time. What's her story?
Well, she's this character. The constellation between them is also they lack language, and which is because Amin's parents are dead, and they died in a car accident. This is the story she tells him, and she kind of it was very difficult for me to write about her, because I didn't want to make her, you know, a victim. I wanted her to be a strong, independent mm-hmm. character. But when she tells this lie, it's with good intent. So I didn't want her to be a liar, you know, someone mm-hmm. who constantly lies. She has this one lie, it's her only lie, but it... and she does it to protect him in a way, but it's exactly this lie that, you know, then initiates all the... initiate the story, basically. She is, if you want, all the women I talked to, all the mothers, all the grandmothers, all the daughters of the missing, because they kept telling me, you know, that for 40 years sometimes, they are now in their 70s, 80s, but for 40 or more years, their life looks like this. Every day, the phone rings. You answer that phone hoping, you know, that the person missing is the one calling. Or every time it knocks on the door, they open the door hoping, you know. They walk on the street, they see a man resembling, or they, you know, they are adding the years that have passed, you know, okay, this is my how he might look today, maybe that's him. So it's torture. And at the same time, these are very strong women who keep fighting for answers which they don't get, because the people in charge are the ones in part responsible for making people disappear. So I really wanted her to be a strong character. But you asked about the constellation between them, and this is this is exactly this, the lack of language. And again, great love, great affection, but and in a way, writing about his grandmother and writing his story is kind of saying, "I love you," you know, from the past, from the future. He writes this in 2011. His grandmother is not alive anymore, but what happens in 2011, the uprisings in the Arab countries coming closer to Lebanon, all these revolutions, you know, this sparks his memory of his childhood. And of course, his grandmother was part of his childhood. So it's kind of love letter again. And he misses her. This is again where the missing comes mm-hmm. in. Yeah.
Because Amin's grandmother begins painting again once she and Amin are settled in Beirut. And her work, which she hangs in this cafe that she's opened, it's very abstract, it's mysterious to Amin. And later he realizes art gives us a place to hide. Do you think that's true of all art forms, including fiction?
I think it can be. I think it's especially true for stories, for storytelling and writing, but I think it can be true for any kind of art. Yeah, because I think for me this is one of the essential things in the book, that, you know, the question, what can art contribute when language is not there, right? When a society refuses to answer or to ask questions in the first place, and then to answer them, what can artists contribute to bring up these questions? And if you look at Beirut today, politicians are not asking questions, of course. They don't want the past to be a topic. Most people in the society don't want. But if you have someone talking about the past, it's the artist. You have street art, you have the theater plays, you have movies, you have many different, not many, but you have people coming from different arts trying to ask this question. You know, what can we do to get reconciliation, to get some kind of agreement that we have to talk about the past, because we cannot build on nothing. We can't build a future on nothing. We need something to agree on.
The novel Song for the Missing gives us glimpses into the lives of women and the problems they face in the Middle East. There's the story of Yara, the grandmother, the career that she wasn't allowed to have as a young woman. There's also Zara, a teenage girl who's forced to flee her home after her father discovers that she received a present, a story from Amin. What happens there? I mean, well, I'll just say, what happens there?
So you want me to sum up with that, what's happening?
Well, no, I guess I want to know whether there's, you later give these women more opportunities, and I just wondered, do you think that women are getting more opportunities in Lebanon?
It really depends on where you look at, of course. I mean, you have, the younger the generation, the more self-confident they are, the women, the more... You have feminism in Lebanon. Of course, it's not comparable to feminists in Europe over here. But they are there, and they are claiming space, and they they're getting louder, and they are. Of course, I mean, we have this this stupid cliche of all the women in the Middle East being somehow. Suppressed but or weak because they are forced to be weak, and while there are of course many structural ways to keep them weak, they more and more refuse to be weak, so I wanted to show that in the novel that of course they are strong women in the Middle East. They are even stronger than the men in the novel. Also in the first book, they not appear as much as the men. You know, if you count them on the pages, but what they do and how they affect the story and all the other characters, they have much more influence. And And I mean, again, talking about the relatives of the missing, how strong do you have to be to live through that, to endure that, and still stand there and say, I want my answers, and I refuse to back down just because you tell me to. I mean, this is really strong.
There is these mute processions of women passing a display of photos of the disappeared in the city streets, and it's like the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo in yeah. Argentina, still marching weekly, nearly 45 years later,
yeah.
And it's another powerful image that speaks to the legacy of pain and loss from the civil war in Lebanon. But I don't know if I'm giving you the answer in the question, but why is it so often the women who insist on remembering?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if I have an answer to that. Maybe it's because it comes just from the simple case that most of the time it's the men who are missing, so the trauma is inflicted on the women, so they have to be the ones, right? Maybe this is just a simple answer, and maybe also it comes from from concepts like motherhood the role they're playing in families, and when you consider families being somehow microcosms of societies, it's always the women, being the ones responsible. So maybe I'm just speculating here, but I think a safe way to answer that would be that the trauma is inflicted on them, so they are the ones getting hurt, so they are the ones who have to have that voice.
Although you also have the not so benign image of these older Lebanese women peering out onto the streets, monitoring what younger women are doing.
Yeah, I mean, there's both, right? There's not just one. There's both.
There are so many riddles and puzzles and secrets to unlock in your novel. I don't want to give anything away, but Amin makes discoveries that turn on a different light on everything that he's experienced. And at one point he says, they say we're the sum of our memories, that these fragments are woven into an elaborate fabric known as our identity. But how are we formed by things we've forgotten, suppressed, or never truly understood? How do we fill those voids? How would you answer that? What would you think is the emotional impact of that?
I'm really fascinated by topics like, you know, trauma that can be really inherited by. I think you can see it in the DNA sometimes. The researchers have found out that third generation, if something terrible happened in a family that was suppressed and not talked about, it's very likely that you know, things like depression in third or fourth generation is somehow very likely to come up, and so it's in the body, and it's somehow inherited, really. And and also I'm fascinated by the question of, you know, what is history, and, you know, and because it in the end I think it comes down to a story that has been agreed on, and then the question in Lebanon is, if you have no agreement on one story, isn't that maybe even a more authentic way of history, you know, of writing history, although it is not being written, because you have many stories existing at the same time, and they are somehow all equally true because they resonate with own experiences, and these experiences shift depending on where you look. So you have many existing stories, and somehow you had no one winning the war, you know. So you had no one dictating basically what the story. There were no winners dictating the story and the history. But these stories keep living. And while I don't think this is a good thing, I think it's a terrible thing. It's a dangerous thing. I think that at the same time, it's somehow authentic. Authentic history somehow. Yeah.
But you've remarked Lebanon and Germany have very different relationships to their histories. How does that play out in the culture? I mean, is that something that you can talk about?
You mean how the fact that Germany has somehow spoke about World War II, how that affects our culture? I mean, what you have to see that in Germany, not before the 60s, these things happened, you know. So there was also a long time of silence, and I think this is you cannot just end something and then immediately start talking about it and relive, because talking about it always means reliving it somehow. So it's said that, you know, it takes a generation to be able to talk about this, which is what happened in Germany, I think, and this is what makes me somehow hopeful for Lebanon, because that would be now, you know, that would be now, that it's starting now. And if you ask about the culture, I mean, yeah, it's being taught in schools, and there's no doubt that, you know, that we were the ones who started it, that thing, and who did terrible things, and so there's an acceptance of that, and there's also the agreement that, you know, it's kind of a responsibility of all the following generations that we prevent something like this from happening again, which is maybe the difference, you know, that this agreement has not been established yet in Lebanon.
In your novel, Amin says he's surrounded throughout his childhood by exiles who romanticize their homeland. It's the most beautiful place, the most romantic place, but it's not a place that any of them want to return to. And it's not surprising, I mean, you that there is such the Lebanese diaspora. I mean, as you've pointed out, it's large. More Lebanese live abroad than live in the country by multiple folds.
Yeah.
You know, and you were saying, being there recently, you witnessed how dark Beirut is, and that there are so many. There's a financial crisis, power shortages, a boat full of asylum seekers that recently capsized in the Mediterranean, drowning almost 100 people. Not to mention, on the other side, that Lebanon has taken in more than 1 million Syrian refugees. Mm-hmm. Where do people find hope?
In the small things, maybe, you know, just. But I if you are realistic, and this is what my feeling was 3 weeks ago when I left Beirut, is that that hope has somehow vanished. You know, not disappeared yet, but it has become less. There's less hope than a couple of years ago, and I think that the explosion contributed a lot to that because that thing happened at a point when there were uprisings. There was already an economic crisis. There was already the younger generation realizing that if they want a future, they have to leave the country because it's impossible to go to university in Lebanon and find a job, which again has to do with the system that you have to have a certain religion to get a certain job and so on. So the country was already in a situation where you thought, okay, how is it supposed to get worse? And then it got worse with the explosion. And so they are really struggling. I mean, they have an inflation of 200%. People can't afford bread. They are, you know, exchanging their television for diapers. So it's unimaginable. If you had asked this question 3 years ago, my answer would have been different because there was this energy, there was this, okay, and for the first time you had people on the streets saying we need change across generation and across religion. They were on the streets saying they all have to go, the political class, we need something else. And this went from the end of 2019 to the beginning of 2020. Then COVID hit, which was for the government a nice excuse to, you know, for lockdowns. So these uprisings,
the demonstrations,
they stopped. And then we're talking about March now, 4 more months until that explosion. You know, so they were basically hit at a point where they had great hope. And when you're hit at that point, where you believe in change in that brutal way, that, you know, everything is 30 years of reconstruction of, you know, and your ideas, everything vanishes, and you see, so this is really hard to recover from, and they're still struggling.
The last chapter of the novel is set during the Arab Spring in 2011. Amin reports to his friend Zara that Hakawati, traditional storytelling, is making a comeback. You're now the father of infant twins. What kinds of stories do you or will you tell your own children?
Well, I'm looking forward to that. They are 18 months old now, and they are. I keep bringing books, but you know they're more interested in the pictures for now. But I'm looking forward to the day when we will sit there, and I will, like maybe my father, invent stories for them. And I'm not sure what kind of stories that will be. I mean, I'm half Lebanese now. They are quarter Lebanese, but they are twins, so they are half Lebanese together. I'm not sure. I mean, of course, I will bring them someday to Lebanon, but not in a way, you know, that I will make this differently. I will not make them experience Lebanon like I experienced Lebanon. You know,
as paradise? You're going to deny them paradise?
Yes. I will try to give them a more realistic impression by talking, you know, about that, which is what we didn't. You know, we just experienced, and of course, what we experienced was beautiful. And there is still this beauty. I mean, we are talking a lot of negative things, but if you go to Lebanon, it is one of the most beautiful countries, really. You have the ocean, and if you can swim and look at the mountains, who are covered with snow, so you can swim and then go skiing, and the same day. You have the food, you have the people, you have the hospital, you have so many beautiful things there, which makes the tragedy maybe even bigger. And of course, I mean, I will try to show them that there is both.
It's a great pleasure to meet you. Thank you very
Same.
Much.
Same, thank you very much.
You have been listening to Books and Ideas Audio, a presentation of the Vancouver Writers' Fest. To hear more events like this one and view our upcoming events, visit our website at writersfest.bc.ca.